You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're into the second hour right now, and thank you for rejoining us for this live broadcast. And we've got a number of big stories that we wanted to plow through here, and some of them are located in the vicinity of Ukraine. We'll get into that in a bit, but we're very pleased to have Christian, one of our research assistants for the show, to is carrying over from the first hour. And Christian, you know, before the break, you brought up this issue of Scottish independence, and I think this is very interesting, especially in the post Brexit paradigm that the UK is currently in. So you were up in Scotland recently, and I don't know, does this topic come up with your Scottish friends and colleagues up there? I mean, what's the general feeling on this? Is it something that's aspirational, or is it not practical to be out of the United Kingdom set up? Or, you know, what do you think on this issue?
Yes. So did the Scottish independence topic come up? It did. It was very light in the conversations that it did. And I kind of wonder whether people wanted to tread on eggshells about the topic itself, just because they weren't sure what my views on it would be. That I found was quite intriguing. But of the people we did talk to about it, a lot of people were kind of indifferent about it, to be honest. They were like, well, I can see why people want to do it, but we don't really mind either way. And there was lots of talk about mainly where, so England's, or rather Britain's, nuclear fleet is based up in Scotland. You have a large amount of the fisheries are up in Scotland off the North Sea. And there's a lot of industry up there in regards to water, to, obviously, that kind of major industry. The green power is mainly up in Scotland in regards to the wind power. So there's a lot of talk that Scotland could stand on its own as an independent country away from England. But Scotland is heavily dependent on England's income, because we basically fund their college and university educations for free up north of the border, which is considered to be a really good thing to have. Having free university educations is a powerful step that Scotland has. So if you live north of the border, that's free. As where if you live in the UK, it's about, I think it's currently 13,000 a term. Mm-hmm. 13,000, sorry, it's pretty expensive. So that there are pros and cons to it, but part of it is because they don't really have a currency to stand by, was a stumbling block. The person I stayed with, her neighbour, he spoke of like, well, Scotland will never stand on its own because it can't afford to not be without England, he said to me, because they can't have an interim currency. They either have to be with the pound or have to be with the euro or whatever they choose to do. And when I was in Scotland, in fact, I went to Edinburgh and I actually went to the Museum of Money, which is the Bank of Scotland's museum, and how money effective as a currency system was obviously quite pioneered there, and how Scotland's kind of infrastructure is actually all about money, and how that was a large part of the conflict going into the 1700s and 1800s was all about currency and money, you know, making a stamp, and how it was all made, how it was all distributed. Really interesting place to visit, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, the currency is a big thing. I mean, you're talking about sovereignty. That's number one, isn't it? What currency are you going to be using? I think the big one of the big pushes on Scottish independence came from a lot of independence type people, some in the SNP, a Scottish Nationalist Party, that basically saw Brexit happening and kind of considered that an affront, because a lot of certain class of people north of the border identify themselves with Europe or with being in the EU. They like being in the EU. They think there's a lot of benefit to it. They want to be part of the European family. And so they said, well, if you're going to leave the EU, you're talking to England and Wales and Northern Ireland, if you're going to leave the EU, well, we don't want to leave the EU, so we're going to go independent and we're going to rejoin the EU. So we want to be part of the European family. We can survive without London. So, I mean, that got a lot of that was getting a lot of traction for a while. But, you know, how practical is that? I can see the sentiment in terms of the national identity sentiment. And Scots have a, you know, well within their rights to be extremely proud of their country, their history, all the great innovations and things that they've brought to the world. And they have brought a lot to the world for such a small nation. And also in terms of culture. So they have borders, they have culture, language. There's some Gaelic artifacts there in terms of language. But you know, they've got a lot, very strong national identity, actually much stronger than I dare say, really anywhere else in the UK, as far as I know, with an exception of possibly Wales. But the practical aspects of it, Christian, in today's interconnected world, there's been a lot of problems with Brexit. So what about a breakup of the United Kingdom? Like, what would that look like in terms of problems? We're just getting a taste of that with the border problem in Northern Ireland with post Brexit. I mean, what about Scotland? What would that look like?
Yeah, for sure. What would it look like? Is it for those who are technically dual citizens? Would there be conflict? Would there be because a lot of people kind of have a very aggressive stance of that we need to stand independent, and they could go whichever way. It's quite remarkable. But I mean, the SNP has found itself in a lot of corruption scandals. It's certainly over, I think there's the Ferguson Ferry situation. They gave like 97 million to them over some kind of vested interest group. I'm not quite sure of the details, so I probably shouldn't comment any further. I know that was certainly a big issue that was a sticking point for Scotland. What happened, of course, with Alex Salmond, you know, that kind of almost a witch hunt for him because he was speaking out against some of the things that happened within the party. That was early last year. I'm just looking down the resigned surgeon trending topics on Twitter, and a lot of those kind of topics are popping up about why people want her to resign. And again, a lot of the mentions really are about corruption. So I guess a lot of people stand by the terrible kind of management that's happening above north of the border.
Yeah, the accusation is that Nippy and her gang have created a one-party state north of the border. Like, there's no political alternatives, and then they're micromanaging the police force, they're micromanaging the judiciary. Craig Murray, the great journalist and the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan and the great activist and champion of Julian Assange's cause as well, he was clearly stitched up in a political trial that was very much related to the Alex Salmond persecution as well. And there you see, that's what a one-party state looks like when they weaponize the judiciary against political opponents. That's kind of scary. I mean, that's what we're seeing in Washington right now on a big level. But that's also happening in Scotland. So I don't know. I don't know what the future is of that party that's really kind of ruling the roost. There don't seem to be very many viable alternatives at the moment in Scotland, so it looks like they're stuck with that setup, Christian.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any, because I guess if you were in Scotland, you would just say, if you were to oppose the SNP, it sort of would say, well, you don't agree with Scotland and you don't want our independence. I guess that would be the view that you've got over there. So therefore, you would have to align yourself with London, which would strengthen the SNP's view for independence. Because you have to be of an opposing voice, don't you? That's the whole purpose of your party. You have to be in opposition to what the other one is. So if you are in opposition to the SNP, you must be thus pro-English, thus it might not get traction. So I guess they've kind of got a bit of a win-win control system going on up there. But and what you said there, that corruption, that poor management, but also equally, you have control over every aspect from the policing, you know, to local political decisions. They could all be swung in your favor, and no one is to know the better.
Yeah, and also this move towards devolution, which kind of started getting, you know, momentum in the 1990s, to the point now they have devolved, parliamentary institutions in Northern Ireland, although Stormont's been dormant. Scotland has, Wales has, and then Brexit comes along. And it was a very interesting development because, you know, if the Northern Irish border situation is actually a big, big deal, because, you know, if that's a deal breaker for people on the island of Ireland, both in the north and the south, and then there's this movement for United Ireland. A lot of young people are very much pushing for this. It's steadily gaining momentum. So if because of the Brexit issue, and now not having EU on both sides of that border, allowing it to be porous, allowing free trade and freedom of movement to go, then if it becomes a customs issue, then all of a sudden you don't have an open border between the north and south. And so that's a breach of the Good Friday Agreement. That puts peace in jeopardy. That creates instability. And so the Good Friday Agreement in the late 90s to pacify the troubles that were, you know, brewing at the time, was only able to be, in my opinion, having looked at it very closely, that deal was made very easy by the fact that both sides were in the EU. Had they not been in the EU, then you'd be tossing over the same issues then as you are right now. And so, yeah. So that's, I don't know. These are just factors that seem to be structural factors beyond the control even of, you know, people's political whims. And so the UK could break up because of Brexit, could be the beginning, theoretically anyway, the beginning of the breakup of the United Kingdom, possibly.
Well, you say that. I mean, when we talk about what that devolution looks like, I mean, I'm aware that I get the newsletters from my local city council, and like, so Nottingham has actually positioned itself to also take powers away from London and to become a independent like city here, much in the same way that Birmingham is pushing to, and Manchester is to become de-evolved and separated from London entirely in regards to its infrastructure and money. When I look about how America did that, you have city states and states that have their own income, they have their own budgets, and that are completely separate from the national state. A lot of those places don't do very well, particularly ones where they've got a deficit and it's going the wrong way, or you're not bringing in money from your local taxes. And I mean, Nottingham, for instance, is going through major scandals in regards to its investments of late. So I don't know what that would do for our city, let alone anyone else in the country. But, you know, to have cities also separate themselves into countries, as well as countries separating themselves to become their own, it just sounds like an absolute mess.
It is. And Manchester is an interesting story there. But I'm here with Christian. We're talking about the post-Brexit hangover, devolution, and the future of the United Kingdom. This is a very interesting conversation. We're going to try to continue this on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. Stick around. We'll be right back.
George Eliason on TNT Radio.
And we're going to talk a lot about Ukraine today. What's going on? And get into some issues that people aren't touching on enough. Now, there was a lot of talk over the course of a couple months about Russia using chemical weapons in Ukraine. And the Biden administration kept insisting it was going to happen. Zelensky's administration kept insisting it was going to happen. And across Europe, every PM, everybody echoed this. Everybody was so sure Russia was going to use chemical weapons in Ukraine. Well, Russia was certified as not having chemical weapons about 10 years ago. They just don't have them. That presents kind of a problem in that scenario, but what were they actually trying to do? On May 30th, or 31st of this year, a chemical weapons incident happened.
George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere, it is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swimming in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white,
you a racist, and if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice, it has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
Because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism.
I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke at salemnow.com.
Our mission is to educate, inspire, and honor.
This is the sound of honor roaring. This is the sound of a generation rising above.
We want to be involved in the education of young people so that they can take the stories that our pilots tell and realize their own dreams.
The Commemorative Air Force honors the heroes of yesterday while educating and inspiring the heroes of tomorrow. You can learn more at soundsofhistory.org.
We were told that the last presidential election was the most secure election in history.
Nope, not by a long shot.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're cruising into the second hour of this live broadcast here on Tuesday afternoon on the south coast of the United Kingdom. Wherever you are in the world, we really appreciate your listenership this week. And I'm joined by Christian, one of our research assistants for the show. And before the break, we were talking about the devolution or the potential breakup of the United Kingdom. Not what form that breaks up into is still unknown, but Christian, I think there's been a number of things that have happened over the last few decades that seem to be trending in a certain direction, and it is really, really strange. I just look at the long arc of this, Christian. And you're talking about even Nottingham, which is not a major city. It's a substantial city, but it's not a big industrial powerhouse like a Manchester or even a Birmingham and it's looking to devolve. So the regionalization of the United Kingdom, which is a relatively small country, but is regionalizing. And so what's going on there? What would the future governance structure look like? Would it be a city-state type arrangement with regions folded within a wider European structure? I mean, Brexit now, but we could be back into a European structure in the future. Who knows? But what do you think?
I have wondered that, actually. I can remember about 2004, 2005, I came across a document online that was from the EU, and it was the proposed restructure and a replan of the UK into different regions, where it had like Cornwall as a particular section, it had like parts of East of England, and there was a lot of argument about when that document came out. And it kind of showed that what effectively is East Anglia and the Norfolk would actually be kind of overseen by a Denmark minister, and that caused a lot of controversy at the time, because it kind of drew a circle around a section of Denmark and also a section of East Anglia, and that was just kind of caused a lot of controversy. Oddly enough, in the last while we were on the break just now, I was listening to some of the comments that have come up in the last hour or so in regards to the Northern Ireland situation. So there's a plan today to unveil the Northern Ireland protocols, that apparently went through this morning. They were unveiled publicly. And it shows here that, again, Liz Truss is, she's trying to explain the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, and she's stating that it's the EU who is not coming to the table to allow them to have the legal precedent to help Northern Ireland through this process. And so they've had to forward these protocol bills forward. But what it's doing now is now the EU is now challenging back legally, saying that that is not a viable option, and they will not agree with it, and they will legally oppose what this bill will allow, and basically causing more of a blockage in Northern Ireland and making it difficult there. Liz Truss actually said here that the Parliament in Northern Ireland hasn't actually sat since February, affecting discussions.
Yeah, dormant. You brought up a key point there. You know, so what do you think? What do you think the EU is playing at here? Because, you know, are we back to European power politics? Because, you know, Britain made that move, made the Brexit move, and that was basically not. It didn't go down well in Brussels, and then eventually they resigned themselves that it's a reality and it's going to happen, and they, you know, but they could easily be pushing the situation towards a united Ireland, which would effectively shrink the United Kingdom and shrink its power and influence, and increase Ireland's power and influence as well. And I'm not talking about immediately, but, you know, a united Ireland referendum could be on the cards. You know, Sinn Féin, you know, incredibly, that's the majority in the north now. So if there was a Irish-wide all-Ireland referendum, it's quite possible that they would go for united Ireland. I mean, is that something that Brussels wants or doesn't want? I think the answer is obvious, Christian. What do you think?
I think there is certainly going to be an element within Brussels or within the wider European Parliament and constituency there. That is just like, you know, they stuck it to us and we're going to make sure that we get our revenge in some capacity. I believe that Boris Johnson and who those who helped organise that exit in the fashion that it did, you know, will have something to answer to when the EU goes, well, screw you. We'll stick you out of things. We won't make you involved, and we're not going to make you a partner. And we'll get our revenge economically and sanctionally, perhaps in some way in the future. So this morning, Sinn Féin's Vice President Michelle O'Neill said that Boris Johnson was in clear breach of international law over his plans to override with this Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. And she's talking on Sky News actually presently about that.
Yeah, is that Sinn Féin Northern Ireland or Republic on the South?
No, I don't know. I see the title just says Sinn Féin's Vice President.
Okay. Yes.
I don't know who she represents, so.
Oh, probably likely the South. Oh, we can check that. But yeah, that's interesting. I mean, they got to be honest. You know, they got to be honest and just say, look, come out and say honestly. I think Michel Barnier, you remember he was the kind of chief Brexit negotiator for a while on the Brussels side. You remember that?
I think so.
Yeah. So he was also involved in the negotiations to help midwife the Good Friday Agreement back in 99. And so again, London and the politicians need to come clean to the media and the public and just say, look, we understand that the Good Friday Agreement was very much possible because at the time we were both members of the European Union. So there was no issues regarding the porous nature of that border. And that just made that agreement easier. So the peace in Ireland was made easier because of the European Union. And it wasn't because the EU did anything specifically. It's a structural issue. It's a structural reality. And it's almost like why that's not coming up in the conversation, because I think when we get realistic about it, there's a lack of realism in politics, Christian. I'm noticing this more and more. There's a lack of realism in geopolitics. The sides that are kicking and screaming and all of these issues tend to be doing it from this kind of petulant partisan position, not just in Britain, by the way. I'm talking about this is in Europe, this is in the United States. Something's happening, Christian. It's a bigger trend, actually. What do you think? Can we call this a detachment? of the political world from the real world? What do you think?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, when you combine that with what's happened over the last 20 years, I'm sure Brian and Mike will agree that, the last 20 years we've seen a move in politics to be leaders as opposed to on the whole process around reframing and retraining and change agenda. We've certainly seen that. And the people who are in power now are those who've gone through that training. And so I suspect that might have, a tickle in there, at least to a globalization kind of factor, that they would want certain factors to fall to make certain goals come about.
And what do you think about, when you say Brian and Mike, you're talking about from the UK column, right?
Correct, yeah. They've been very vocal over the last 10 years regarding the change agenda, particularly in regards to, what was it called? Common purpose.
Yeah, common purpose. Right. Yeah, interesting organization, that one. Interesting organization. You know, they got funding. So this was like a covert, I think at the time, their principal, Julia Middleton, who's a sort of rabid Marxist, as it goes, they wanted to have an old boys network equivalent for the left. That was the original, I think, idea behind it. So a secret organization, political organization that did leadership training, and they would sort of look for potential operatives and leaders, bring them to these intense, kind of almost cult-like weekend training sessions, including late nights and who knows what else, and then dispatch them back into their institutions and local government, national government, and so forth, and we always wondered what that was for, like why, what was this push for? So this looked like a kind of coordinated infiltration, but they're being funded by Deutsche Bank.
Yeah, and it didn't just happen in the political sphere, it happened in the private sector, in the business sector, whole reframing, they changed managers into leaders and rebranded them. And yes, you're kind of seeing this kind of weird sort of Marxist leftist liberal ideology across all business, across all politics. I don't know. It's probably not related, but it's like there's enough tendrils in there that make it look like, is this an interconnected factor?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a significant factor. So no longer servants of the people, no longer public servants, but leaders, right? That's the reframing, right?
That's right, yeah. But for the greater good.
always for the greater good, always. How do you feel? You're in the heart, you're in the heartland of the United Kingdom. You're in the sort of the middle of the country, middle England. Oh, what do you think? How do you feel now, 2 years into Brexit? What are you noticing? Any differences, positive, negative? Do you notice, do you have this conversation? Does anybody speak about this anymore? What are your impressions on this?
It's interesting you say that. A lot of people just say they're glad it's done, or glad it's out of the way, or glad it's over. But when you start talking about particular people's jobs, and a lot of people, they all recompense sympathetically to those who are struggling on the East Coast in regards to the fishing trade. There's particular stuff. Import and export costs have gone up, so they feel their life and their way of life and the value of money they have has decreased significantly. But they feel that they are finally able to say they're English or finally able to say they're British, but feel that they are still getting kind of slapped around by, again, I hate to use the word liberal left, but it does kind of feel that they're still not allowed to celebrate their individuality, they're not allowed to celebrate any sovereignty, and they feel that that's now more restricted than ever. In one-to-one conversations, that is something that people will do say. And there's now a lot less funding coming locally. For a time, you would always see little plaques what said funded by the EU, funded by the European Social Fund, funded by European Social Grants. You don't see those as often anymore, and you've certainly seen a lot of almost like private and public partnerships have kind of stopped. That was like the Sure Start centres. They also were very popular, of course, with the Labour Party. They brought those in. But they also had signs up saying they were funded by the EU, and that funding went away and they closed down. You see that in the doctor's surgeries. They often have the EU signs that were on there. They're not no longer in there. And then they had to close all those surgeries and make them into these kind of multifaceted buildings that contain the library and the social, like the social council, and all those kind of public services have all been molded into one building as opposed to lots of other buildings to save money, perhaps because they're not getting that money from the EU anymore. Although that just, I guess I'm speculating, spitballing on that one. That's just something I've seen. But what people do say is they just generally feel that they're glad that we're not part of the EU because they thought that the EU was controlling the UK to a point that was unfair, and they were taking decisions against their country and against the people that they didn't feel that we had any say in. And I guess that is something a lot of people felt. That they felt that the EU was clearly a very powerful bureaucratic system that didn't even answer to anyone, not even itself.
Yeah, the sovereignty point is very strong. I think it was very much underestimated. The media wasn't saying that wasn't motivating people. The media wouldn't admit that. You remember it was all they came up with all these other sort of conspiracy theories, including that Putin was driving Brexit. You know, there's like everything you can imagine. Yeah. So yeah. You remember that. It was just like the Russians were behind it. Kara Cadwallader, who's a total Russophobe. Yeah.
Cold, of course, was a Russian.
Oh yeah, they're masterminding it from the bunker in the Kremlin. So that's interesting. That's an interesting conversation. You know, it is. It's the businesses I'm talking to post Brexit has been a bureaucratic nightmare, and so also with duty taxes and things like that, the people that had suppliers in Europe that finishing off the goods here, things like that. It's been totally killed. It's no longer financially viable. So it's driven up the price of a lot of things. Actually, had an inflationary impact. For the UK in the last 2 years. That's worth noting considering the current crisis right now. I think overall, this sovereignty issue is big, and Europe could become a basket case at some point. At the same time, there could be a move if the political pendulum shifts because of this crisis spilling out of control. There could be eventually, if the government goes down in flames, there could be a renewed movement back towards Europe. But you know, as far as I can see, Christian, the Anglo-American partnership, the Americans, you know, basically are doing everything possible to undermine the EU's strength and influence. And so I think the Americans were very much, the deep state in America was very much backing the Brexit movement, but not for the reasons that you're saying people feel. They're looking at it from a geostrategic point. They didn't want an EU army, for instance, you know, a European army that would compete with NATO and basically kick America out of European affairs. Basically unacceptable. And so they will do everything possible in their power to make sure that doesn't happen. That's a part of the story that a lot of people are not wanting to tackle, because then you're getting into some hairy territory there with regards to the Anglo-American arrangement, you know, vis-a-vis Europe. But yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, because I mean, although we would like to believe that, of course, that Washington and London are on board with each other, I mean, there is much, you know, political backbiting and leveraging back and forth between them two sides as it is, as well as, you know, they always still want, you know, to have the upper hand on each other, the high up in intelligence, and they're always willing to drop the other one at the drop of a hat, regardless. I mean, that's the thing, not, like you said, not spoken often about, is that there's always a checking and a counter-checking everything, even between allies.
Oh yeah, like you know, the Australia had a democratically elected, albeit probably you could call him a socialist, Labor PM in Gough Whitlam back in the mid 1970s, and he wanted to get rid of the NSA listening station at Pine Gap, and you know, basically take U.S. Influence out of Australia. And lo and behold, he was ousted in a kind of bureaucratic coup not long after that. And it's widely regarded. There's been a number of good, you know, things written and a great documentary on this at the time that chronicled this. The U.S. literally did regime change in Australia because Australia was going off the U.S. reservation, basically. So that's how it far is a good example of how far the hand the hand of Washington extends. But anyway, we're going to go to a break here in a minute, and I really appreciate you, joining us in this hour, Christian. It's been a great discussion, and certainly there's a lot of important points to consider on these issues that we're talking about today. But thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you for having me.
And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That's Christian. He's one of our research assistants for the show. Appears normally on Tuesday here on the program, and we're very pleased he was able to join us for an extended discussion into the second hour. But we're going to take a short break right now with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We'll be right back after these messages.
According to the New York Times, Biden has granted the Earth climate stability due to higher gas prices.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
In the You Can't Make This Up department, a 2012 New York Times op-ed claimed that a carbon tax would result in higher gas prices that would result in, quote, climate stability that would prevent, quote, an end to life as we know it, unquote. The 2012 op-ed by Cornell University economist Robert Frank claimed that increasing gas prices by several dollars would achieve a solution to the climate crisis. Fast forward 10 years, and Joe Biden must have solved climate change, with gas prices more than doubling in the United States, going up several dollars a gallon. But wait, it's all so confusing. In 2012, the New York Times said cooling the climate would create climate stability. But the same newspaper in 1976, during the global cooling scare, warned that warming the Earth was the only way to achieve climate stability. Yes, don't question the science. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
A man's home is his castle, but his men's shed, that's his kingdom. There are now more than 1,000 men's sheds across Australia, and they're more than just a shed. You can make things, grow things, find a mate, be a mate, shoulder to shoulder. The Australian Men's Shed Association can help to find a shed near you.
There's something for you at the men's shed.
Mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host for this live broadcast today on Tuesday. Thank you very much for joining us, and very pleased to have this discussion with Christian about Brexit, about Scottish independence, devolution, the future of Europe, of Britain. And it's interesting how geopolitics is lurking in the background all the time. Of course, that's the bouncing ball that we're not allowed to see. You know, we have to follow the little red ball that the mainstream media presents for us. Keep an eye on that. Follow the tunes. Sing the refrains, the usual, and that's all you need to know. And anything else, well, that's not going to be entertained in this conversation. That's why we're having this conversation. This is why this radio network is so crucial, to provide a forum, a platform to have these types of more informed, deeper discussions, and more educated discussions as well. And there's a great range of programs on TNT, Today's News Talk. This program, we hope you listen to us every Tuesday and Thursday at 1 p.m. UK time, and all the other U.S. And other international time zones. You can work out where you are in the world. We really appreciate your listenership, but also there's some other great programs as well on this network. It's chock-a-blocker with great programs. And I've got some bad news for everybody. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but we have to announce this. According to the European Union, the geniuses in Brussels, you have to understand, it's a smarter breed of humans in Brussels. Well, they think so, at least. They've been bred to rule. They've been bred into castes. This is what the elites believe. It's like a H.G. Wells time machine. Did you ever see that film with Guy Pearce? That's not enough. Jeremy Irons plays the ghoulish character from the future. He says, "We've been bred into castes." and everybody has their place and their role. Well, that's certainly what the elites and the technocrats in Brussels think. And so much so, they've made this grand announcement hot off the press. The EU buys 111,000, there must be some significance numerologically to that number, 111,000 vaccines, or I could say that like Bill Gates, vaccines. The EU buys 111,000 vaccines as monkeypox spreads across the continent. Well, that's interesting. So I didn't realize monkeypox was contagious, because when monkeypox arrived on the scene, sort of like a support act for COVID, you know, COVID continues to tour like the Rolling Stones. It continues to tour the media and the minds of small minds of men and other paranoid people. So it's doing the tour. COVID is the rock star. COVID is the highlight, is the featured act. Monkeypox is a supporting act. So monkeypox is like, what would be the equivalent? I'm not sure. Sort of a second tier act, does the tour as well. So we're told when it started, monkeypox wasn't contagious. We were told that and said, don't worry, it's just spread through gay sex. That's what they said. I mean, the whole narrative was ridiculous from the word go. They're announcing the EU's buying vaccines. Wow, that's great. Do they even have a vaccine for monkeypox? Have they isolated and purified and isolated a monkeypox live virus? Can we see evidence of it? Of course not. Of course not. They're referencing some paper here and written in 1967. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, that'll do. A scientific paper, peer-reviewed by who, we don't know, published in 1967. That's the evidence for monkeypox, literally. So just as COVID was beginning to seem like a distant memory, a new virus is on the rampage. Are we reading this correctly? This is a major, this is news.com.au, Australian. Mainstream media outlet. Just as COVID was beginning to seem like a distant memory, a new virus is on the rampage. And now leaders are starting to take action. Oh, thank God for our leaders. Thank heavens for our leaders. At least somebody's in charge. The European Union, the paragon of all great being and intelligence, those who know better than any of us how to manage the human race in Brussels. They are set to sign an agreement for the supply of, this is interesting, the headline says 111,000, and then the text in the article says 110,000 doses of monkeypox vaccines. So it's not actually monkeypox vaccines. It's a repurposed smallpox vaccines. So how could, if you believe in vaccines and that they work the way they say they work, well, how can you cure monkeypox with a smallpox vaccine? That doesn't make any sense. It's not specific. Is anybody asking this question? They're not asking this question. Not in this article. Nobody's asking this question. That's if you believe in vaccine theory. 110 doses of the monkeypox jab as the virus is spreading through the Northern Hemisphere. This is what they claim. Look at this. More than 900 cases of a killer disease have been diagnosed in the EU. Shock horror. 900 cases. And out of those 900, how many actually bona fide monkeypox? What is monkeypox? I've got a better fundamental question here. Why is it that monkeypox has the exact same list of symptoms as 100 other ailments, from shingles to chicken pox to other skin diseases and rashes and outbreaks? Why is it indistinguishable from all of those others? So how would one know if you had monkeypox? Is it just like up to the doctor's whim? Well, that looks like monkeypox. Write it down, Nurse Ratchet. Write it down. Monkeypox. Good Lord. So 900 cases of the killer disease. How many people have died from monkeypox? If it's a killer disease, wouldn't the infection fatality rate be very high? Well, it doesn't look like it is. So why, how is it a killer disease? Okay. There's another 470 cases in the UK. So it doesn't count as Europe anymore. Our last conversation. So that's funny. So anyway, out of the who knows what, 400 million people in Europe or whatever it is, 1,370 cases out of 400 million. Yeah, okay, whatever. That's just nothing. And it's not contagious. They already said it's not contagious, but they say it's spreading. This is what they call doublespeak. The vaccines will be delivered to an undisclosed manufacturer from the end of June. I can't imagine who that is. Can't be Pfizer. Of course not. At the meeting, EU health ministers in Luxembourg and the European Commissioner for Health and Food and Safety, who's overseeing this non-tested vaccine. Great. Oh, it's been approved. We have nothing to worry about. It's been approved. Wow. And this is all being paid for out of the EU funds to secure the doses. Great. So that's a bailout for the pharmaceutical industry. They got some cash out of that. So yeah, get the scare up, ramp up, run a few articles in the press, get the guaranteed contract paid for with public money. You're just laughing all the way to the bank. These pharmaceutical companies never had it so good. They really haven't. This is very sad to read. So what are they calling? Highest infection rates in Europe. Oh, Spain, 259 cases. Ooh. Portugal, 191. Ooh. Germany, 113 cases. Ooh. Wow. Those are the highest infection rates in Europe. This is a joke. This is a bad joke. Wow. What can you say? How ridiculous does it have to get before people just like throw their hands up and just stop believing in any of this? They keep running this. Okay. Well, we have to defer to the United States Center for Disease Control. I love how the Europeans, in order to make their case and bolster their claims, will always quote the CDC in America as if it's some legitimate organization. The CDC is run by a bunch of pharmaceutical stooges. Big Pharma has taken over that agency a long time ago. And now it's totally politicized under the Biden administration. I think they've got some incompetent failed academic, Rachel Walensky, I think her name is. She was put in there. Biden said, we need a woman. We need a woman of color. Same old story. So we have, and this is what they're saying here. This is from the gospel. This is from the Pope herself, Pope Walensky. She says, we have seen presentations of monkeypox that are mild and sometimes only limited areas of the body. Blisters, which differ from the classic presentation seen in endemic countries like Western and Central Africa. There's been no monkeypox epidemic in any of these African countries. What on earth is she talking about? Wow, this is what happens when you put incompetence in charge of important national agencies. You get statements like this. But who cares about the facts? Just, you've got a narrative, run with it. So according to Al Jazeera, always a great source to quote, the Qatari royal family says that the EU's drug regulator, oh my gosh, that's an oxymoronic term as well. They're not regulating anything. Was in talks with Danish biotech firm Bavarian Nordic over trial data that could underpin an extension of the approved use of Imvanex shot, known as Jynneos, in the United States, beyond smallpox to include monkeypox. Right. U.S. regulator previously approved the manufacture of smallpox vaccine for the use of monkeypox. So I just said that without even knowing, having not read the fine print. I said at the beginning that they don't have a monkeypox vaccine. They're repurposing a smallpox vaccine. How on earth would that work? And so the fear mongering here on this is just incredible. So I've got a picture of someone in Africa with their hands. There's no credit to the photo. They could have got this literally off of a website. This could be stock photography. This could be, I'll tell you exactly where this photo comes from in a minute. But so they could have got this straight off some other website. And this is what you've seen with a lot of the monkeypox stuff that you're seeing in the media. A lot of it isn't actually from actual reporting. They're literally just cherry picking images and then saying that's monkeypox. So, and then they're posting it in articles that claim to be covering the monkeypox issue. So that we've caught them doing this so many different times. So I can actually tell you where this particular photo comes from. I'll just do a quick reverse image search on this using that tool, TinEye, TinEye.com. And you do a reverse image search on this particular image, and we'll find out where the source of it is. And we'll see if this is indeed monkeypox or if this is something else. So a little live digital forensic activity here on the show. And I'm just going to run a reverse image search on that. That's up at news.com.au. And let me see. Is it monkeypox? Apparently, they claim it could be. 2021, it looks like the earliest appearance of this could be on 2021. It's from a stock photo agency. Yeah, a stock photo library. And there's nothing there. Apparently this is a photo of someone, African guy's got blisters on his hands. Looks like he's been doing woodwork. Maybe he's been building, who knows, had a reaction to something. 1997. A suspected monkeypox infection of an African man. We don't know what country he's in. There's no information. Okay, the Democratic Republic of Congo, 1996 to 97, a characteristic rash appears in the recuperative stage. This virus, which is found near rainforests in Africa and West Africa, causes disease in humans and monkeys. So that's it. So I'm telling you, so the media doesn't tell you where this stuff comes from, but I just took 2 minutes and I told you exactly where it comes from and what the context of that image is, as best that we could work out. So again, this goes back to the One Health agenda. If you remember, we had Freddie Ponton and Miles of Truth last week on the two programs on Tuesday and Thursday, breaking down the One Health agenda, and it's about zoonotic transfer. Zoonotic, the jump from animals to humans. That's what it's about. So zoonotic, the phenomenon of zoonosis. This is what underpins the One Health agenda, and the One Health agenda is about political control. So think COVID, think the fake lab leak story. The gain of function thing is science fiction. I've spoken about that in the past. Science fiction, pure science fiction. There is no provable gain of function in the virology side of that theoretical practice. There's absolutely no proof. There's a ferret study. It's a joke. Dr. Sam Bailey debunked that pretty thoroughly, as have others. The whole gain of function thing, and the lab leak, China and all that, it's got a geopolitical side to it. It's designed to demonize and get more Americans to hate China. It helps to prep them for the war to come if there's going to be a war. This is useful. But what it does is it creates this this myth that there's these viruses everywhere, coronaviruses in this case, and they jump from the bat to the pangolin to the Chinese wet market guy and to the Chinese lab and then out into Wuhan and then literally in lightning speed around the world in 8 hours or whatever, you know, a couple of days. It's in all these countries. I mean, who believes this stuff? are people that have just become so paranoid and so insecure and, quite frankly, so gullible that they'll believe any narrative if they think there's a crisis imminent. They literally believe any explanation, and they think that that's good information. That this is what caused the whole lockdown hysteria. And, you know, that might have well been on the cards. It might have been a pandemic, and there's aspects of that. But, you know, you got to go and actually look at the science that's underpinning some of these claims. We have, and there's nothing there, quite frankly. It's a joke. It's beyond a joke. Anyway, look, we're going to take a break and we'll be back for the third hour, and we're going to get into the Donbass, Ukraine, as deplatforming, cancel culture, and more. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. This is TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.